What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pakistan has been getting more than its share of headlines lately. There's the case of Mukhtaran Bibi, gang-raped 3 years ago, whose attackers were released from jail and her passport confiscated to prevent her from traveling to the United States. The result, an international outcry and new attention to Pakistan's human rights abuses. Meanwhile, Afghanistan is accusing Pakistan of harboring Taliban fighters. U.S. intelligence officials have hinted that Pakistan is a weak link in the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and there is evidence that jihadist training camps there are flourishing. Still, President Bush has praised Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf, hailing him as a hero for cooperating in the war on terror. And Musharraf has pledged his support in a potentially explosive part of the world, where the U.S. has a huge stake in maintaining stability. Tonight on Point, losing patience with Pakistan's human rights record and what that means for a strategic, if somewhat uneasy, alliance. We begin this hour in Lahore, Pakistan. I spoke earlier with journalist Ahmed Rashid, who writes about Afghanistan and Pakistan for the Far Eastern Economic Review, the Wall Street Journal, and other major publications. I asked him how Musharraf has responded to criticism about the Bibi case.
Well, he has been away in Australia and New Zealand, but he has defended his action very strongly. He has said that he took the decision to take away her passport so that she could not travel to the United States, and he took the decision to warn her off, to prevent her from doing so. He also condemned the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations in Pakistan, for supporting her and for throwing their weight behind issues such as women and children and education. And he seemed very exasperated when he made those comments. Now, obviously, these comments have caused quite a shock in Pakistan, especially amongst Pakistani liberals, etc., and especially at a time when Musharraf is supposed to be allied to the United States in the war on terror, and there is a big American push at the moment to try and promote democracy in the Middle East and the Muslim world.
In the streets of Lahore, where you are based, are people aware of this case and of the controversy that it has stirred up internationally?
Yes, certainly, because she has been on TV a lot. She has been on talk shows, local talk shows. She's become quite a celebrity. But it must be said that there is also a very strong fundamentalist opposition. The Islamic parties detest the idea that she is becoming some kind of celebrity or some kind of hero for women or for human rights or for liberal people in Pakistan. And Musharraf, I think, is trying to play to the Islamic gallery, because politically at the moment he cannot afford to annoy the Islamic right wing, because it's in power in two provinces, but also because he has very little political support in the country. And if he annoys the fundamentalists too much, and they have already taken a very strong position against him, they consider him as pro-American, etc., if he takes too strong a position against the fundamentalists, his own position becomes much weaker in the country, and particularly in the army, where he draws most of his power from.
So fair to say, then, that some view Mukhtaran Bibi as a heroine and others as a threat?
Yes, she epitomizes in a way the kind of very deep polarizations that have now come to exist in Pakistani society, especially since 9/11. The deep polarization between democratic parties, politicians, liberal thinking, etc., and, if you like, the fundamentalist camp, which is opposed to anything related to what it considers an American agenda.
Well, you've actually written that Musharraf's growing international standing is at odds with his faltering position at home, which is certainly not good for any leader. In fact, you've said that his government appears to be unraveling. That's serious.
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, Musharraf is a military ruler who's also a president, who attempted in 2002 to set up a civilian front, as it were, for military rule. And the fact is that the civilian front has proved totally ineffective and inept, as we've seen with the handling of this Bibi case. It is totally inept. It has no idea what the left hand is doing or what the right hand is doing. As a consequence, he has very little public support. The liberals would like to support him, but he's constantly veering off to the right. The right don't like him. The fundamentalists don't like him at all. They mistrust him because they consider him a liberal at heart, and they're quite happy to rock the boat if he takes any kind of dramatic stance, such as, for example, defending women's rights or doing away with some of the very prejudiced Islamic laws against women. But the bottom line is that really he has no political support in the country except the army. And he has to constantly look over his shoulder and see what will play well in the army and what won't play well in the army.
Well, and with that kind of division within Pakistan, it has to make you wonder if in fact he can survive.
Well, I think, you know, for the time being, he's there, but you have several benchmarks coming up. You have local council elections coming up later this summer, which are going to be, again, very divisive between democratic parties and Islamic parties. And then there's the big question of, is he going to take off his uniform? There have to be elections by 2007. And if the army is planning again to have a kind of rigged election as it did in 2002, I think that will cause enormous popular discontent, which could well spill out into the streets. And then, of course, you have, you know, ongoing tensions with the Americans over the Taliban, over the issue of where is Osama bin Laden, where is Mullah Omar. You have tensions over the nuclear issue. At the moment, the Americans have decided it's better to be on side with Musharraf than off side with Musharraf. But again, you have a very, very tense domestic situation.
Well, I wanted to flip that around as well. We know that there are many in the U.S. who have issues with the U.S. relationship with Pakistan. What about in Pakistan? Are there similar misgivings about Pakistan's relationship with the United States?
Certainly there's widespread dislike for this relationship by the fundamentalists. But I think in recent months, with the treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, this whole issue of flushing the Quran down the toilet, true or not true, all these issues, I think, have created an enormous dislike of the United States and of this whole alliance. And that's coming from people who support democracy, who would like to see an end to military rule, who would like to see the fundamentalists brought under control. The prisoner issue, the Quran issue, I think, has galvanized people. I would speculate even possibly more than the U.S. attack on Afghanistan, and possibly even more than the U.S. attack on Iraq. I think there's a deep, deep frustration now with the public over U.S. actions. And that, of course, makes it very difficult for anyone to take a liberal stand. Maybe part of this Musharraf posturing over this Bibi case is to show that, look, I'm also fed up with the Americans, with what they're doing, and I'm going to take a hard line now with the Americans.
Ahmed Rashid, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Ahmed Rashid is the author of Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He spoke with me from Lahore, Pakistan. We're talking this hour about human rights abuses in Pakistan and the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. Do the reports of human rights abuses there make you want to cut off America's alliance with Pakistan, or is it simply too important strategically to abandon? We invite you to join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from New York is Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist for The New York Times. He has been writing about Mukhtaran Bibi and other human rights abuses in Pakistan. Welcome, Nicholas Kristof. So good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Let's start with a bit more of the details about the Bibi case. First, what exactly happened to her 3 years ago?
There was a dispute in the village involving her brother. The village is divided between a higher caste group and then her group, her tribe. And apparently, in fact, what happened was that members of the higher status group actually raped her brother, and then to cover it up, accused him of having an affair with one of them. But then, because they were all saying that he had this affair, then a tribal council decided to punish her family, or you know, the boy's family, by sentencing her to be raped. And so this tribal council officially sentenced her to be raped. She was raped by four men and then forced to walk home almost naked in front of a crowd of about 300 jeering people. And, you know, in that society, her obligation was pretty clear. She was supposed to commit suicide. And instead, with the support of a local Muslim leader, she somehow summoned just incredible strength and fought back and went to the police, testified against her attackers in court, sent them to prison, and emerged as this amazing spokeswoman for women's rights in Pakistan, and then used compensation money to start schools in her village.
And she's in the fourth grade, I believe you wrote?
That's right. She was originally illiterate, but she believes really passionately in education, and she thinks that, you know, the best way to overcome these kinds of attitudes that led to her rape are to educate people. And so that's why she started one school for boys and one for girls. She herself entered. She's learning Urdu, and she's in the fourth grade of her own school. The day after she was released from the government, you know, in her latest mishap, she was back in class, and she's also enrolled the children of her attackers.
It is an incredible story. I want to continue after we take a brief break and find out about why she was planning to come to the United States and then exactly what happened to her. We'll continue in just a moment. We're talking this hour about Pakistan's human rights record and about whether the United States can afford to change its policy with this important ally in the war on terror. We invite you to join the conversation. Is it possible for U.S. leaders to apply pressure without jeopardizing a strategic relationship? Is it okay to have a double standard on human rights with countries that helped the U.S. in the war on terror? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we invite you to join the conversation. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking tonight about Pakistan's internal problems. If President Musharraf is doing all he can to curb human rights abuses and keep fundamentalism in check, and whether U.S. policy there should change. You can join the conversation. Does the U.S. still have the high moral ground when it comes to standards of behavior around the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And continuing now with Nicholas Kristof, columnist for The New York Times. Nicholas, why was Bibi planning to visit the U.S., and what happened to her then?
She'd been invited by a group of Pakistani Americans to address a symposium about human rights issues in Pakistan. And, you know, she's eager to talk to anybody who will listen. Also, I think she feels a lot of gratitude to Americans for the moral support they've given her and also for the financial support. So she was eager to come. And then the Pakistani government just kind of went berserk at this. And it seems to have come from the very top, from President Musharraf. I mean, he himself actually says it came from him. They barred her. They put her on something called the exit control list, which bars people from leaving. Then they put her under house arrest, and then when she was giving interviews, bitterly protesting what was happening to her. And I mean, she's an incredibly brave woman. She's just really unstoppable. So then they kidnapped her and, in effect, and brought her to Islamabad. Also began kind of a smear campaign against her in the Urdu language press. Fortunately, it generated a certain amount of attention. The U.S., to its credit, protested, and she was released. Her name was taken off the exit control list, but then they took her passport. There are some indications that will be returned to her.
Well, you know, at bare minimum, you have to think, what were they thinking? Did they really think they could shut her up? Did they really think they could do this without the rest of the world paying attention?
Yeah, you know, I think that the Pakistani diplomatic corps, for example, I think they were horribly embarrassed. I mean, they're very sophisticated people. They're, you know, sensitive to how things look, and I mean, I think there is a genuine embarrassment that people don't want. They're proud of what Pakistan has achieved. They feel embarrassed about people associating Pakistan with gang rapes. On the other hand, they also regard her as really a genuine heroine. But Musharraf, I think, he's a lifetime military man. I think he thinks in terms of how to control things, and I think he regarded her as an irritant and thought that he could kind of use muscle to silence her. And I mean, it just backfired and made him look awful, made Pakistan look bad, and now they're in damage repair mode.
Well, and there are also some damage that needs to be repaired from other cases that are coming to light. You've written about a couple of them, including an 11-year-old little girl named Nazan.
Yeah, she was a girl who, and this happens in some rural areas in Pakistan, also in Afghanistan for that matter, where as part of a kind of a family package or to settle a dispute, a very young child is married to a much older man, and that's what happened to Nazan. Usually the girl is transferred to the husband's family only at puberty, but in this case, Nazan was transferred earlier, and her in-laws decided she wasn't working hard enough and just beat her mercilessly, broke her arm, hung her, dangled her from the ceiling, and this kind of thing. And I read about another case recently, also this year, where a 2-year-old was betrothed as part of one of these deals to a 40-year-old man. And so I think it is important to remember that Mukhtarin is one case, and an incredible case just because of who she is and her willingness to fight back and to try to improve the system. But she is only one facet of a huge problem.
Well, indeed, as you write, there are two incredibly chilling statistics about how a woman is raped every 2 hours in Pakistan, and every 2 days another woman dies from an honor killing. Why has the government not stopped this? Is it simply not able to, or is there not the willingness to?
I think that there's a little bit of both. And, in rural areas in some parts of Pakistan, and that's true of Punjab, where Mukhtarin is from, there are deeply embedded cultural attitudes, I think really more cultural than religious, which kind of regard a girl or a woman as property, and when you want to punish a family, then one traditional way of doing that is to shame a female in that family, and that's the context in which a lot of these rapes arise, including Mukhtarin's. The government, President Musharraf has sometimes talked a good game about this, and indeed, right after Mukhtarin was raped initially, he brought her to Islamabad, he met her, he gave her some compensation money. But he, I think, has been reluctant to take on the Islamist parties, who take a deeply traditional view about women in Pakistan. And more fundamentally, he's, I think, more interested in kind of sweeping problems under the carpet than in actually dealing with them and addressing them. And I think he's really ended up more as a part of the problem than a solution.
And finally, do you see his hold on power to be as shaky as we heard just a few moments ago from Ahmed Rashid?
I go back and forth on that, there is a real risk about what would happen if he were ousted. I think he has done a reasonable job in cooperating on the war on terrorism, and in terms of Pakistan's own interest, a pretty good job in promoting economic growth, and that is certainly in the interests of women and girls throughout the country. But I think that the thing that has been working in his favor for the last few years has been this notion that if Musharraf goes, then Pakistan will completely collapse. And I think that, in reality, that's not the case. If he were ousted, another military leader would presumably take over. And Musharraf has been pretty good about cleaning out the Pakistani military forces of the really hardline Islamist people, and you get somebody who is, you know, kind of like him, a sort of modernizing, secular general, you know, who would try to promote economic growth. And so I think we should be, I mean, I think Musharraf would like us to fall into the trap of we either choose him or complete chaos. But In fact, I don't think that's the choice.
Well, Nicholas Kristof, columnist for The New York Times, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Hussein Haqqani, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and associate professor of international relations at Boston University. He's also written extensively about South Asia. His new book is called Pakistan Between Mosque and Military. Welcome to you, Hussein.
Pleasure being here, Gail.
Let me ask to you, if you will, to pick up on the thought that Nicholas Kristof was just talking about, you know, what might happen if Musharraf were no longer in power. Do you think Pakistan would collapse without him?
I think Pakistan is going to collapse because of him rather than without him. The assumption that an individual can save a country is a flawed assumption to begin with. General Musharraf represents the Pakistani military, which institutionally has run Pakistan since 1958 with very brief intervals of civilian government. And the civilian governments have constantly been battered and interfered with by the military. No civilian government has ever been allowed to complete its term by the military. So we've had elections as a result of which governments have come into office, but no government has been allowed to be voted out of office. And the Pakistani military gets the lion's share of Pakistan's resources. Even now, the US aid package that is going to Pakistan, a great bigger share of it will go to the military than it will go to civilian society. So General Musharraf basically is the nice face of the Pakistani military's entrenched corporate interests.
Well, if he can keep the support of the army, is that enough to keep him in power?
Not necessarily, because the army always needs a face that will have the support at least of the people or and can get international support. And right now, General Musharraf is faltering on both counts. But as Nicholas Kristof said, the military will probably present another candidate. I think what we need to do is to look at the longer-term problems that Pakistan poses, because since the beginning of this program right now, Gail, you haven't mentioned one key thing about Pakistan. Pakistan is a country with nuclear weapons. So here's a country with a very small per capita income, with 33% of its population living below the poverty line, which is on less than $1 a day, with cases like Mukhtara Bibi's case taking place quite frequently, and with a very strong and powerful military which will not allow civilian society to emerge. With such inequities in that society, I think the United States needs to look at the longer-term implications of all of that rather than just whether one individual talks the nice talk when he comes to Washington, D.C., that one individual being General Musharraf.
Yes, well, that's clearly a key point. I wonder what else might be on your list of the biggest issues right now, particularly between the U.S. and Pakistan.
Well, I think the biggest problem between the United States and Pakistan is the war against terrorism. And here, initially, again, the United States made an error in taking General Musharraf at face value. And now we are discovering that the quality of the cooperation that Pakistan has extended has not been increasing as the U.S. had expected. What the U.S. expected immediately after 9/11 was, here's a country that has been supporting the Taliban. Here's a country that has trained militants to fight against India in the disputed area of Kashmir. Well, if they turn around, if they announce that we are going to come on the other side, then they will gradually come into become a more open society, less militaristic. What General Musharraf has instead done is that he has given the cooperation in dribbles, in very small doses. And the dosage is not increasing, which is creating some restlessness on the part of the United States.
And some might say it's even getting smaller. I want to bring Saeed into the conversation now. He's on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, Saeed.
Hi, Gail. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And what would you like to contribute here?
Well, a comment and a question. The first comment being, as the writer from the New York Times was saying, cases like Miss Bibi's case are, you know, more or less, I won't say they're completely confined to the rural areas, but more or less in the rural areas. The problem I'm from Pakistan, by the way. The problem in those areas is that you're so entrenched, you know, with the society, with your peers, that so many times what happens is you are sort of forced into doing things that you don't want to do. For example, the BB case. I mean, I was just mentioning the same thing to the person who took my call, that hey, if there were even, you know, a dozen decent people in the village where this happened, they would have at least tried to stop it from happening. And you know, on the other hand, you see 300 people jeering this poor woman. I mean, my heart goes out to her. I mean, I'm Muslim, obviously, but you know what? Islam doesn't say this, and you know, it's such a miscarriage of justice that people are still being forced into these things, and you know, there is no recourse, and she has to come to the U.S. to speak out about what's happened to her, and she can't say the same thing in Pakistan, and which sort of shows what sort of, you know, government sort of running, that people can't air their views. The second question is that, you know, with the war on terrorism going on for the past 4 years, so many people have read about cases, you know, in the press that, you know, the CIA and, you know, and so many other agencies have shipped people to Pakistan where everybody knows that they're tortured and all. So it's sort of a double standard here that, you know, on the one side we're saying, all right, Musharraf, you know, we'll turn a blind eye to these people, which we think are terrorists, or, you know, and there's no proof, or they are shown to be terrorists at the end of the day. And then on the other hand, we're criticizing for these cases and not acting up.
Saeed, thanks for the call. Hussein, I'd be interested in your take on that.
Gail, the first point, I think, is a very important point. The most important question is a society moving towards positive change through the intervention of the state? Does the state come out on the side of the victim, or does it end up supporting the people who do something criminal like that? Of course, there were decent people in that village. For example, the religious leader who helped Bibi make her case and go to court. Otherwise, it would never have even gone to court. So he was a decent guy. He stood up with her. But the problem is that the court system, which General Musharraf controls, because he managed to get the Pakistani Supreme Court to endorse his military rule, which was totally unconstitutional, he has always managed to get decisions from Pakistani courts in favor of most of his decisions. The court system did not support Bibi. And I think that societies which have flaws like this, they can change only positively if the state, the weight of the state, the weight of the judiciary, the weight of the executive branch of the government comes out on the side of the victim rather than on the side of the perpetrators. On the second point, I agree with your caller that the United States, by the way, I must tell you that I was once kidnapped by Pakistan's intelligence services and tortured, so I, for speaking out on political issues, despite having served as the country's ambassador once and having served in government at very senior positions, including cabinet level. And so if a person like me wasn't safe, you can understand how a poor person living below the poverty line like Bibi must have to face the wrath of the state. The whole question is, can we build civil society in Pakistan that can gradually take over from the state, where the executive branch and the military and the intelligence apparatus virtually controls all aspects of life? And should the U.S. be helping the building of civil society, or should it just be putting more aid into the coffers of the military intelligence apparatus?
Well, and also getting back to your point a moment ago about how change had to come with the weight of the state to change some of these cultural issues in particular, and some of these ways of meting out justice, if that's what you want to call it. But does that have to occur internally? Can the United States really do anything about it, or is that more likely to be resented than to be helpful?
It can happen internally. After all the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that are supporting Bibi and that General Musharraf has now lashed out against, all of them are internal organizations. These are Pakistanis. Whenever the Pakistani people have been given a chance to vote, they have voted either for the center-right Muslim League, led by Mr. Nawaz Sharif, who used to be Prime Minister at one time, or for the Social Democratic Pakistan People's Party, led by Benazir Bhutto, who, while she was Prime Minister, created special police stations for women where women could report rape. Both those governments were discredited by the military and the intelligence apparatus as corrupt. Ironically, that corruption charge stuck. I'm not saying that there was no corruption. There were instances of corruption. But corruption was used as an excuse to end democracy. And the military, because it has these grandiose strategic designs, considers human rights either as an inconvenience or even a hindrance to its own control of civil society. Now, the Islamists that people mentioned earlier, Ahmad Rashid mentioned, they have never had much support in Pakistan except as a pressure group which is continuously backed by the military. And that, in fact, is the subject of the book that comes out tomorrow, my book, Pakistan Between Mosque and Military. The important theme is that the Pakistani military ends up supporting the fundamentalists, increasing their weightage in society far beyond their numbers. They never got more than 5% of the votes in the past when they ran for elections. Only in 2002, they got 11% of the votes because Musharraf tilted in their favor, while at the same time proclaiming that he was the one who would save Pakistan from them.
I have to stop you there. We're going to continue along this line after we take a brief break. We're talking this hour about reports of human rights abuses in Pakistan and what, if anything, the U.S. can do about it. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the U.S. relationship with Pakistan and whether the United States is losing patience with this wartime ally in human rights and also in the war on terror. You can join the conversation. Do you think Pakistan is doing everything it can to hunt down Osama bin Laden and to flush out extremists? Are Musharraf's hands tied by internal politics, or is there more he could be doing to enfranchise women, secularize education, and democratize the country? What can the U.S. do to help him? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking tonight with Hussein Haqqani, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Institute for International Peace and former advisor to three Pakistani prime ministers. And also I want to bring Walter Anderson into the conversation now from Washington, D.C. He is Associate Director of South Asia Studies at the Paul Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's also a former chief of the South Asia Division at the U.S. State Department. Walter, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me ask you what we've been wrestling with, get your perspective in the big question here, which is the United States somewhat forced to turn a blind eye to some of these issues because Pakistan is simply too important an ally right now?
Well, that's clearly a dilemma. It's not as if, you know, government officials on the inside who make decisions aren't aware of the issues of democracy and, in some instances, problems regarding certain groups of in the war on terrorism. I'm thinking specifically of the Taliban on the western edges of Pakistan, the borders of Afghanistan. They are aware of those things, and the dilemma is exactly as you said, is that Pakistan is a frontline state in the global war on terrorism, and there's always been a balancing act on those two sets of issues when decisions are made.
And in terms of the U.S. concerns about Pakistani officials may know exactly where Osama bin Laden is, or at least have a pretty good idea. Is there persuasive evidence in your mind that Pakistan, to some measure, may be protecting his whereabouts?
To be quite frank, I don't know. On Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda, the Pakistanis have actually done some significant things in arresting people. Where the weakness is regarding the Taliban. And I think that there's been a certain weakness on that because the Taliban represents a potential foreign policy support base should they need it if problems develop regarding Afghanistan.
Hussein Haqqani, I'd be interested in what you have to say about that as well. Do you think that they're doing everything that they could be?
I don't think they are doing everything they could be, but they have done enough to please some people in the United States government. I think the problem has been that the U.S. expected that this will be incremental. Let's accept what they are offering us and then slowly increase it, and that hasn't been increasing. In case of the Taliban, the very fact that Pakistan continues not to crack down on them basically provides al-Qaeda with the support base that it needs along the western border of Pakistan with Afghanistan, because after all, al-Qaeda comprises primarily of Arab extremists, and these Arab terrorists cannot survive in Pakistani society without some local support. And it's very interesting that almost all major al-Qaeda figures that have been arrested were not arrested along the border, but in major Pakistani cities, obviously living with Pakistani extremists who were providing them shelter.
Well, go ahead, Walter.
Can I add one thing?
Sure.
At the same time, almost no Taliban senior figures have been captured, which is curious.
And one of them was just on television the other day in Pakistan, so clearly somebody, you know, he's not that hard to find.
Sorry, Walter, I think the Pakistani Intelligence Service wants us to believe that no one in the Pakistani Intelligence Service was watching Pakistani television at the time.
Hmm. Let's go to Belmont, Massachusetts now. We have Shabnan on the line. Hello and welcome.
Hi. I'd just like to make this point that any time any atrocity of any kind happens in any Muslim country, it's always attributed to Islam. I mean, whereas there are plenty of rapes happening in the USA, but nobody says because of Christianity. So I was just wondering why that is.
I doubt if anybody said that this had anything to do with Islam. In fact, I heard Nicholas Kristof very clearly say that it had nothing to do with Islam. Islam very clearly forbids sex outside of marriage and certainly does not condone violent acts of forced sex. And certainly rape is not condoned by Islam at all. And no one has implied that. The unfortunate part of all of this is that we all, I'm a Muslim and a practicing one at that, but we sometimes become too defensive. This is not about Islam. This is about Pakistani society and some segments of Pakistani society who have developed traditions that are not necessarily religious in their origin, but Islamic political parties, for their own reasons, saying leave tradition alone. And some traditions, if they are not good, need to be changed. And Pakistan needs to put the weight of the Pakistani state behind changing those wrongful traditions that have emerged in some parts of Pakistani rural society. That's all.
Could I add to that? The U.S. government has been very careful to not to link Islam with acts that we've just been talking about, or even other acts of violence, that the violent groups have been using religion, but it is a misuse of religion, as Hussein has just mentioned.
And Walter Anderson, I want to ask you something that we were talking about a few moments ago before you joined us, and that was this whole question of Musharraf and his support, that he has very little support among the people, although he is still being supported by the army, and the issue of whether, you know, better the person you know than the person who might be behind him. I mean, do you think that's why the United States might be better off, perhaps, trying to help him stay in power?
I think the U.S. sees him as critical in the war on terrorism. My own view is that countries are critical on these issues and not necessarily people. And I think that, in fact, in our policy, we ought to stress more economic assistance than military assistance. But I think the government should, and I'm not sure it always does, keeps in mind that it's the country and the various governments and not a particular person that's really important in long-range foreign policy considerations.
Well, along that line, Hussein Haqqawi, is Nicholas Kristof suggested also in his column yesterday that perhaps President Bush should broaden the conversation from the F-16 sales when President Musharraf visits the White House next month. Do you see that as sort of the best carrot and stick that there is at this point?
I think that U.S. aid is an important carrot for Pakistan. That's why the Pakistani military always offers its services to the United States in return for economic and military assistance. Unfortunately, it's very interesting. I have the figures in front of me. For each year Pakistan has been under military rule, it has received close to $350 million in U.S. aid. For each year it has been under civilian rule, it has received no more than $130 million. Dollars per year. So two-thirds of American assistance has gone to military regimes, and not because the military regimes were in power for longer, but because the American aid policy was geared towards giving more assistance in the form of, say, for example, F-16s. F-16s are not going to improve Pakistanis' living standards, and certainly it's not a plane that is going to be useful for Pakistan in the war against terrorism. They are not going to use F-16s to bomb their own cities. They may need cooperation in finding improving technological means in the intelligence war against terrorism, provided they don't use it against their own citizens for political purposes. So those issues do need to be attended to, and I think the U.S. needs to go beyond supporting the Pakistani military and going towards supporting Pakistani society, and I think Walter is right. Economic assistance should be continued, but I think that the weightage of military assistance should definitely diminish.
Can I add something about this, the U.S. Support being larger during the times of military rule? That has, in fact, been the case. But the reason that's been the case is not that we inherently like military rule more than democratic rule. It's that military rule has tended to coincide during the Cold War with periods of crisis in which Pakistan was useful for U.S. foreign policy, and then in the global war of terrorism after 9/11, the same situation. So, in fact, advancing our own security interests, we provided money to the government in power, and the government in power tended to be, during those periods, military governments.
Back quickly now to our phone lines to Raleigh, North Carolina. Salim is on the line. Hello and welcome.
Thank you very much for taking my phone call.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I have my opinion. I don't think so. Pakistan is doing anything for us. Pakistan is making America fool.
I'm sorry, making America a fool?
Fool.
In what way?
They're taking F-16. They're taking lots of money from America. I think Musharraf is helping Osama bin Laden.
Salim, thanks for the call. Either of you want to add to that?
I don't think there is any evidence of actual collusion between the Pakistani authorities and Osama bin Laden. That said, I think some of Pakistan's policies are simply wrong. The only way to deal with extremist terrorists is by making no distinction among them. And General Musharraf has consistently tried to make a distinction between Al-Qaeda and Taliban and Pakistani terrorist groups that Pakistan itself trained to fight against India. And I think it's time to shut down shop completely on terrorism and move Pakistan towards a more civilized society where the brutality of the kind that Mukhtar Habibi faced is simply not condoned, simply because society thinks it is more important to achieve some strategic objectives rather than care about its own citizens.
Walter Anderson, is that even possible?
Well, let me say, I agree with Hussein. I don't think there's any collusion between Musharraf and the al-Qaeda forces, and one sign of that is there have been two attempts on his life by groups associated with
possibly al-Qaeda. More than two.
Well, perhaps more than two, but two that I'm aware of, and one against against the prime minister, and one against a corps commander in the south of the country. So clearly there is a problem there. And I also agree that you need to have a unified policy regarding terrorist groups, and if you don't, there's all sorts of problems created as a consequence of that.
Hussein Haqqani, in the couple of seconds we have left, are you optimistic about what's going to happen here?
I think that I see signs of optimism. Pakistani civil society is asserting itself. I think Pakistan's politicians have learned their lesson of not playing to the tune of the military. And I think the United States is right now in the process of learning some of the lessons from the past.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks so much. Hussein Haqqani, visiting scholar for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and also associate professor of international relations at Boston University. Thanks, Hussein.
Pleasure being here, Gail.
And thank you to Walter Anderson, Associate Director of the South Asia Studies Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Thanks to you, Walter.
Thank you for having me on the program.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In just a moment, we'll be checking in on Banda Aceh, 6 months after the devastating tsunami. This is On Point. This Sunday marks the six-month anniversary of the devastating tsunami that took more than 175,000 lives in 11 Southeastern Asia countries and sparked a huge outpouring of financial support from around the world. Workers are still discovering bodies among the debris. Over the past month and a half, more than 2,000 remains have been discovered in Aceh Province in Indonesia, one of the hardest-hit areas. But the long process of reconstruction goes on. Diane Johnson has spent most of the past 5 months in Banda Aceh, serving as team leader for the aid group Mercy Corp. In this radio diary, she says the process of rebuilding has been slow, but much progress has been made.
When I first arrived, the devastation and destruction was just immense, and it looked rather like a nuclear bomb had hit the place. And while there's still huge areas that are flattened and there's still destruction, the amount of debris that's been picked up, you can't recognize the place. It's been a completely different landscape. So there's still not the large buildings rebuilt, but the debris and the destruction has largely been picked up. And it really, we joked about how we had a hard time finding our way around town afterwards because we'd started to point things out by piles of debris or destruction. And by and large, that has been picked up. This was a massive outpouring of private funds from the public. And what that was able to do for us specifically was allow a huge amount of flexibility to, as we saw the needs on the ground or communities came and asked for something, we were able to immediately program to respond to that. And that's very different, I mean, compared to other disasters where you're typically going in with more of a defined plan from a specific donor. In this case, we had this, you know, fairly large pot of flexible money, and it really allowed us to respond more quickly and to do some creative things because we didn't have to stop and write the proposal and sell it to a donor in order to do it. We could really kind of follow the communities as they decided what they needed. So it contributed hugely to the speed and the flexibility of the response to have that outpouring from the public. People were, I think, in shock, rightfully so, very early on. But the thing I've been the most struck by is how quickly they started to plan their recovery. They got up. They wanted to leave the displaced camps. They wanted to open their businesses. Families wanted their children back in school. So, you know, the overwhelming impression is how hopeful and determined they are. I mean, there's so many stories of the people that are really getting their lives back together. And a couple that stand out for me was early on, a group of men who were the survivors from their village had ended up in a displaced camp pretty far from their home village and were working with us on some cleanup projects in the city. And started coming to the office to really express a desire to go home to a place that was 2.5 hours away where the road had been washed out. And that group of men have stayed and were one of the very first villages we worked with that returned home. And they have now, you know, taken up fishing again. They've built shelters for themselves. Their children are going to school in a village across the way. And one man in particular, speaking for the group of men from the village, were so clearly articulating their desire to not be displaced, to not be receiving handouts, but to go home. There's no doubt that this is a long-term recovery effort, and I think, you know, because of the amount of destruction and the loss of life, things will never return to exactly as they were before. But I think, you know, for a lot of people, they'll be able to return to their home village. They'll be able to have schools functioning. They'll be able to get to their livelihoods. But it's probably going to take 3 to 5 years before all of that reconstruction can be done.
Diane Johnson has spent the past 5 months as the team leader for the aid group Mercy Corps in Banda Aceh, Indonesia. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.